So this is Felicia, and you're listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, Kauai Soapbox Live. Today I have some friends in the studio here. Let's see if everybody is on. I have Dr. Stephanie Seneff. Are you there?
Aloha.
Oops, I'm not hearing you. Let's see.
Try Aloha.
Again. Aloha. And then I have Randy Lee.
Hi.
Hi. And Nathan.
How's it?
And Eric.
Nope, nobody can hear me.
All right. And then pretty soon, Dr. Evslin will be in here also. So we're going to be talking about a handful of issues, but we have, for quite some time now, really been exploring Bill 2491. And we will look at different layers of that. There are a lot of heavy things going on out in the world, though. I know globally I've been seeing footage from what's happening in Egypt, and it looks like a lot of crisis and real tragedy that's happening there. And, you know, it's really difficult to tell what's happening from Kauai. I never really know what to trust in our media that we see. It's a tough call, but one thing that isn't tough is people are losing their lives, and that's hard. And we did just get a caller in asking about the shooting that happened on Kauai, and I read what was in the paper. I don't know quite enough. Randy, you know him?
I know him vaguely. I know his brother really well.
And his name is Mason?
Mason, yeah.
And what's his last name?
Sa'io.
Sa'io. I saw the picture in the paper. Looks like a beautiful child he has, And he's from Kalaheo?
From Kalaheo. Originally, his family is from Aiea, I believe. They all grew up in Aiea, I graduated in Aiea High School. It was really sad, actually, because I seen that someone got shot. I had no idea who it was, and I went to Facebook, and all my friends from Honolulu were posting how sad they were for Mason, and I was thinking, no way. And sure enough, it was him. His brother actually came down today to figure everything out. So
he's 21, young man.
Young.
Looks like made a few rough choices at different points.
Yep.
And, you know, I never really know what to see. I'm always a skeptic. I don't know enough to make an informed observation about what happened. I saw that the paper said four police came by to, you know, see if there was any criminal activity going on. I don't know if that's an understatement or an overstatement. I am really sorry somebody died.
So am I. I don't believe that anybody should be killed just for somebody to come drive by and check to see if there's a crime going on. We even lost a friend before, a couple years ago, and he was the one in Waimea that had gotten shot because he had the knife and he had mental issues and stuff, and I still think that there's got to be another way.
Well, I know when they now have these tasers.
Yeah, exactly.
It seems to me tasers are being used when maybe words would work, and guns are being used when maybe tasers would work, though it said that he had a gun in his hand. He was being told to drop it. I don't know.
That's, I guess, why they opened fire. Is, I guess, he had two guns. He tossed one out of the car, and then he held on to the second one. And I guess supposedly he pointed it at the officers at one point while he was in the vehicle, and they opened fire on him. And I guess there's 15 shots fired. And
I don't know.
That's what it said in the newspaper. But we had a caller asking if there's any reports of him actually firing at the officers, and I don't believe there was.
No,
but I'm not saying anything against the police officers.
Exactly.
I can't say, like, hey, you should have used a taser against someone with a firearm. You know,
we weren't there.
Yeah, exactly.
I wasn't there. Generally speaking, when I bring a topic up on a show, I like to know a lot about it, have some primary source people. We did just have a caller. This is a call-in show. We care very much what the listeners are thinking about. You know, it's a very heavy.
In case you don't know situation. The number, 808-826-7771. So feel free to call in anytime.
And what we are prepared to talk about is the perspective of what happens with parents and doctors. Dr. Evslin is probably still working on getting here, and so he will be in here very soon. And we're going to be hearing what the physicians say. I'm probably going to like if a caller wants to call in on what just happened, I'd like to hold off for Dr. Evslin so he's able to hear your direct story.
Definitely.
So we can take this caller. They dropped. Okay. So we did have a caller. Excuse that. And Stephanie Seneff,
yes.
Dr. Stephanie Seneff, research professor at Michigan Institute of
MIT, Massachusetts.
Massachusetts, one of those M states, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. So just while we're waiting, you want to tell the listener what your research background is and why you're in here, because you've studied relative to pesticides
right.
and children.
Yes, yes. I've been interested in autism for a long time, and I have written several papers on autism. I'm really trying very hard to understand what in our environment. It's clear there's something in our environment that's causing the epidemic that we're seeing in autism, and especially over the last 5 or 6 years, alarming growth in the incidence, which I think will project to a very scary situation in 10, 15 years down the road if we don't fix it. So I think it has to be solved. Very hard mystery. I mean, it's a very complex disease. And all the factors that I look at that are environmental, you can see how they could play a role. And it took me a long time before I thought to look at glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup, because Monsanto had assured us that it's a very safe herbicide. And so I did finally start to look at that, study what it can do, and I was completely blown away because it was very clear to me that what glyphosate does to physiology explains mysteries that I was unable to solve in autism. So, of course, I got very excited, and I joined up with a person who's extremely bright, extremely knowledgeable, Anthony Samsel, who's been an expert on environmental toxins for a long time, and we put together a paper.
Can you give us some of those details? You said it answered a number of questions. What questions did it answer?
The really key one was the connection to the gut. It's quite well established at this point that the autistic kids have a problem with their digestive system and typically an overgrowth of pathogenic bacteria and then a depletion of the beneficial bacteria in the gut. And that makes a huge difference. The gut bacteria are really, really important to our health. And researchers are really starting to realize that lately. So lots of papers have been coming out on that topic. And there's an increasing awareness that there is a huge problem with gut bacteria. People have blamed it on antibiotics, but then you have to say, well, why are you using the antibiotics? They use, of course, a lot of antibiotics on the animals, which are also being fed GMO foods that are Roundup ready, which means you can pour Roundup on those foods and on the crops and they won't die. So it's anticipated, and in fact, it's the case that the amount of Roundup that's allowed, the residue that's allowed in the animal foods is much, much higher than what's allowed in our food. So these animals are getting exposed to a lot of this chemical, which is causing their gut to be disrupted. And that's very clear. There have been papers written on that.
I think a challenge that's out there when we're looking at scientific studies is it's hard to find conclusive evidence on any one thing because there are so many stimulants.
Possible causes.
Absolutely. It's a very big mystery.
It's a big mystery. Like I read something very recently that was looking at a corollary between induced birth, you know, when you get Pitocin, and with autism.
Mm-hmm.
And that was interesting to me. But then they said, well, maybe there's a lot of reasons why that the birth has to be induced. So is
right.
it the fact that it was induced, or is it the fact that there was different issues that were going on?
It's a good example. In fact, induced birth often means that they think the baby's overdue and they don't like you to wait too long beyond the due date. But often it may be that that baby needs more days to mature in the womb. That's why it's not born yet. And that also could have been an effect of something like glyphosate influencing the fetus during development that would require it to need to be overdue in order to get the job done because things have gotten delayed. And then you've disrupted that by inducing the birth.
Right. So there's a lot of different elements that can come together. Have you looked at other relationships with pesticides and things besides autism? Like, I'm curious about seizures.
Yes, very definitely. Seizures are related to autism as well. It's amazing how many things are... autistic kids are predisposed for a lot of different other problems, and seizures is one of them. And I have written a paper on seizures, which is a technical biology paper that explains how the seizures can be used to advantage by the brain to produce sulfate. And sulfate deficiency is what I had targeted as a severe problem with autism. And then when I saw glyphosate, I could see how that could explain the sulfate deficiency. So that connects glyphosate, for example, to seizures via sulfate. But everything is sort of connected by, you connect the dots, you know, and then you sort of have a mystery to solve. Very, very hard to get the direct evidence with glyphosate because the research has not been done.
Okay. And Lord's Ban also has a relationship to seizures. It seems like that we've been learning that. I've been learning that in the public hearings. So, Randy, you have a son who had a seizure when he was an infant?
He actually, yeah, 2 days after he was born, he started seizing in the hospital. We noticed it right away. After the doctors took a very long time to come in, they realized he was seizing. They pulled a spinal tap and found blood in the spinal fluid. They did an MRI and a CAT scan. They found his brain had bled. Mm-hmm. And they investigated and they tested for aneurysms, all kinds of blood disorders, if he had cancer, blood clotting, anything. And they couldn't find out why. He was born normally, vaginally, no forceps, no vacuum, no nothing. I was induced. I was induced.
Oh, there you go.
And he
was induced also.
He was beautiful. He came out fine, and then we noticed he was dry. He couldn't breathe, and he was turning colors. Wow. Things weren't correct, and
wow. how big was he when he was born?
He was big. He was 8 pounds, 9 ounces.
Wow. So he was a full-term, full-size baby.
A big baby. Yeah, I mean, Nate and I are big, but he was a big baby and pretty much full-term. They called it at 37 weeks. They said I gave birth, but it's a give and take.
Yeah, who knows for sure. Well, so you live in Waimea Valley.
I do.
And did you grow up in Waimea Valley?
I grew up in Waimea Valley during the summers. I lived there from when I was 13 all the way through. I was raised in Washington State. My mom thought it best to move us there and have the opportunities that they have there for us. And I came home when I was 13. I lived there, and I've been island hopping back and forth. And I met Nate after I graduated, and we had Nakana, and we've been there ever since.
And so, how was your pregnancy in the valley?
Oh, yes. The whole time I was pregnant, I was in the valley. Waimea Valley, between my grandma's house and my husband's house. My grandma's house is directly across. There's a huge cliff where Pioneer is on, and you see the dust grains. We're directly across from there. The majority, about, I would say, 5 months of my pregnancy was spent there, and the rest was spent by my husband's house, a little further up in the valley, but also very close and adjacent to the Pioneer Fields.
Wow.
But your son had his first reaction when he was still in the hospital.
When he was still in the hospital.
So it wasn't from something he breathed when he came home.
Oh, not when he came home. But the crazy thing is, they told us, okay, the blood on the brain is what is causing the seizure. So it should go away once it dissipates because the brain is agitated with it on there. It stopped. And last year, about September, it started up again. And the doctors have no idea why.
And he's 6.
And he's 6 years old now. Just made six. Mm-hmm.
And so he's on seizure medication?
He's now on Trileptal, a really heavy thing that has made it really hard for our family. He's very agitated. He's actually diagnosed with PDD-NOS, a form of autism.
Yes.
So can you break down that acronym for us? What is PDD-NOS?
I can't. I know what it is, and I know that it's a form. It's a relative of autism. It's something they've... Do you know? I've forgotten the mnemonics.
Pervasive, right. Developmental disorder not otherwise specified.
Oh, there you go.
Okay. Pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified. And Dr. Evslin is in the house now. We've got to get some headphones on him. He might know a little bit more about that, but we've been talking about seizures. And, like, her baby having a seizure, you know, right after birth. in the hospital, but she spent a lot of her childhood and definitely her gestation period in Waimea Valley. And so her son has PDDNOS, mm-hmm. right?
PDDNOS.
Yes. And say the name of the drug one more time.
Trileptal.
Are you familiar with that drug?
No, not particularly. I mean, I see it being prescribed and used, but it isn't something that I use myself.
Okay.
Close.
Yeah, I know. Okay.
So what would you normally prescribe for something like that?
You know, I didn't actually hear the beginning of the issues that were going on. It was essentially a seizure disorder.
He was born with a brain bleed. It wasn't actually, they traced the blood back till about maybe 2 days after he was born. And then they found he lost the 3/4 of his right frontal lobe.
Right.
And that was initially the cause of the seizures because of the brain, the blood on the brain. But we were telling her as it dissipated, it stopped. And then all of a sudden it just kick-started again and started happening. And they don't know why it's happening. They say maybe because he's growing, but nobody knows. It just started happening and it's small. I can still see some sometimes. I can see, like the other night we were watching him and he was sleeping and all of a sudden his hand starts jerking, slapping him in his face for like a minute. We're like, what's going on? Why? Nobody knows why.
And how old is your baby now?
He's six. He just made six.
Just made six?
Mm-hmm.
6 months or six years?
6 years.
6 years.
Yeah.
And how has he been developing otherwise?
He has had a whole bunch of cognitive problems. He's delayed. He was delayed in speech for a while. He was on phenobarbital when he was born, and that just delayed him fully. After being pulled off the phenobarbital when they thought he was seizure-free, he kind of blossomed and bloomed after being off of that drug. But he still had a lot of issues to work with.
And then the seizure activity stayed gone, or now are they thinking that it's returning with this new activity?
Yeah, they actually told us he was probably having little ones, but we just never knew. And a year ago, we caught a really huge grand mal seizure. And then they put him back on seizure medication after that, Trileptal.
And that's the one he's been on.
That's basically the one he's been on, yeah, for the last year.
So they are the newer classification. We, in the older days, Dilantin and phenobarbital were our big drugs. And then as time has gone by, we've gotten these drugs that are theoretically or hopefully have less side effects than the phenobarb that we used so freely before. But more of an issue here is just the progress going forward. The development is... How will the seizures be affecting his life? And so your baby was born here on Kauai? Or?
Correct. Was born in Kauai.
At KVMH? Or?
Actually, I had made sure that he was born at Wilcox, just in case anything went wrong. We were right there in Wilcox. Everything happened at Wilcox Hospital.
Okay. And then the baby was shipped over to
Kapi'olani.
And I didn't hear... The baby was a premature baby?
Nope, full term.
Oh, it was full term?
Mm-hmm. That's why it's very shocking.
Right, right.
And they tested him for everything under the sun, couldn't find one thing. So it's kind of concerning towards us because we have no idea what's going on all of a sudden with these seizures happening again. More frequent, even little ones, big ones. He's afraid. It's ended up happening where he had... His mental records, he has gotten like psychological exams and stuff like that and show that he's afraid of what's going to happen to him because of these seizures. And he's afraid of the world and he's afraid and he's depressed and all these things. And I'm thinking to myself, how can my 6-year-old son be depressed? How can he be, you know, he's a 6-year-old little boy.
Right.
How come, why is he feeling like this? What did we do wrong as parents?
No, these are, I mean, the kind of stories that we hear in pediatric practices in general, and the ones that are so hard on our hearts in so many ways, and just moving forward. The nice thing about children is they so often can heal, but having underlying issues like this where seizures are going on, it can be so trying for the family and certainly for the child. The sign of him being apprehensive is a sign of his intelligence in a certain way, that he's, you know, he's understanding this. He's fully perceptive of all the issues that are going on.
Do you see much of this? Do you see much seizures or much of this type of challenge in different kids on the island?
To a certain degree. All pediatric practices have children that have some seizure disorders. It isn't a large part of most pediatric practices unless you're a neurologist. We think about it a lot. Children will often have abnormalities in motion sometimes when they have fevers, and then they'll extend beyond the fevers where they're having twitching kind of activity. So we have to think to ourselves, you know, is this seizure activity? So children will have movement disorders that we're looking at hard and wondering if they're seizure activity. And then a certain subset of the children have true seizure activity that we need to treat. Fortunately, we have good neurologists on Oahu, and we send the children over, and they guide us through the anticonvulsant medications. And so all of these children with seizure disorders are treated as a team approach, basically, with the pediatricians providing the primary care and the neurologist nicely adjusting the medication or adjusting the medication through us and helping us.
Is there much of a genetic link for tendencies towards seizures? Is that something common, or is it? Do you think it's largely environmental? Are we able to determine that? Has there been an upswing in seizure activity?
I can't say that I've known there to be an upswing. Now, my office is in Kapaa, so I'm not taking care of people, particularly on the west side of the island.
But you used to run the hospital.
Yes.
In Lihue. So you had island-wide patients.
I did, and I didn't sense that we were having an upswing in seizure disorders, for sure. So seizures are a response to the brain's being insulted in some fashion, insulted meaning irritated. And when children seize, we're looking for, is it idiopathic? Is it something that we're not going to find the cause of it, or is there something that's causing it? So we end up doing testing, EEGs and MRIs and so on, to see if there's something in the brain that's fixable. And sometimes there is. Sometimes it's even something like a small tumor. And the majority of the times, we don't find a reason. In this child, where there was actually bleeding going on, so there was something that irritated the brain and was being watched carefully. And then, unfortunately, that can leave an irritation that can show itself at some future time period. So that may be what's going on in that situation. When we work a child up for seizures, if they're at birth, we're looking for congenital infections. We're looking for birth trauma. Later on in life, we're looking for trauma in general and for brain abnormalities. And very commonly, we don't find ever exactly what the cause was, and we just then treat the symptoms.
So one of the reasons I invited you in here is I felt that you gave extremely compelling testimony in the 2491 hearings, the bill known as the Right to Know. And when I had met Nathan, Randy's husband, a lot of concern over being downwind of these chemicals. I don't want to infer, there is an inference. I don't want to say factually that there's necessarily a corollary, but seems like there's a number of seizures that are happening in their neighborhood. Randy's nodding her head very strongly. There are other kids.
There are other children that have one of our friends, their son's having seizures all of a sudden. Everything was fine, and they're saying that it's febrile seizures, just from having fevers and stuff, but mm-hmm. it just keeps happening and happening. I have another friend whose son has seizures. This is another seizure disorder. One of the things that we're kind of concerned about is the drift. Would it be enough, the smell, to trigger them to have it? Because even though they may have a seizure disorder, can the drift trigger them to have a seizure?
So the answer to that is I don't specifically know. What I was testifying to was the fact that the American Academy of Pediatrics came out in November 2012 with a technical paper. So it was 20 pages long and 195 references, and it essentially said, we, the American Academy of Pediatrics, are becoming concerned with the effect of pesticides on children, and that the data is becoming increasingly robust, is the kind of word they use, meaning it's becoming more and more compelling that the unborn child and the growing infant and the growing child are particularly susceptible to pesticides. And the areas that they were finding the most evidence were leukemias, brain cancers, neurodevelopmental problems, endocrine problems, and other evidence was pointing towards other diagnoses such as asthma. And what they were saying is, we see the association, it's definitely there. We're looking, there were 195 scientific papers that were used to write this, what they call a technical report. And then from the technical report came a policy statement from the American Academy of Pediatrics. And what the American Academy of Pediatrics is the body that represents most of the board-certified pediatricians in America. And they convene scientific committees to look at almost everything that has to do with healthcare. And their mission in life is to improve the health of children. And the policies set by the American Academy of Pediatrics become worldwide policies because of the credibility, basically, the American Academy of Pediatrics. And what they were saying is, this is becoming alarming to us. We are seeing this association with these childhood problems. And it's also becoming very evident to us that we don't know enough about it. Our pediatricians don't know enough about chronic and acute poisoning, which is true. It's not a big part of our training. Because the labeling isn't sufficient, we don't necessarily know what's in the products that people are getting. And what the point they're making on that is, the labeling shows the active ingredients, but it doesn't show the inactive ingredients, which could be 98% or more of what's in there, and the inactive ingredients may also be playing a role. They're saying that we're becoming alarmed enough by this that we want the pediatricians of the world to say to the parents, what are you spraying in your house? What are you spraying on your yards? And if you're in agricultural communities, is there drift? And if you're the parents whose occupation is to be an agricultural worker with pesticide spraying responsibilities, be aware of the fact that you may be bringing this home on your clothes and on your bodies, and that that may be having an effect. And what they were calling for is a variety of things. Buffer zones, for one. Right to know was another. Three, that we enlarge our knowledge base enormously, that we need to be, with the right to know, we need to then be studying what's happening around areas that are having spraying, that the data is convincing, but it needs to be much stronger, meaning that we need to keep collecting data. So what I saw was that the bill, 2491, the components of the bill were so similar to what was being suggested in the policy statement by the American Academy of Pediatrics, they almost lined up one-to-one, mm-hmm. that it seemed to me, of course, this is what we need to be doing. And I'm proud that the people of Kauai are saying, okay, it's time to do these things that need to be done. As I looked at all this, one of my big hopes is that the bill isn't put on a hold to gather more data. The data has been collected by these bodies, basically, and put together in a compelling policy statement. The data is there that says there's danger in the pesticides. In my mind, we do need to study Kauai. We need to study it by zip code and disease entities, but it shouldn't stop moving forward on doing the things that should be done now, which is at least buffer zones and the right to know and things to decrease our exposure.
And you are listening to KKCR, Hanalei, K-A-Q-A, Kilauea. That's Dr. Lee Evslin, pediatrician and longtime physician on the island. I also have Dr. Stephanie Seneff in here, who is a research professor from MIT University, studying the effects of particularly glyphosate, which is Roundup, and autism, but has looked around in different areas. And then we have Nate and Randy Dickinson, and myself and Eric. So thank you for listening in. A question to both the doctors in here. Do you interface with the Department of Health for the state? Like, do you, Dr. Evslin, do you have a vehicle for speaking to the Department of Health? It seems to me that they should be supporting this. I know that Dr. Ball, who is, as an individual, he supports the bill 2491. I don't think he's able to support it from his professional position. He's got, you know, a lot of things that tell him not to be able to do that. But as an individual, he's doing that. Are you giving feedback back directly to him?
Not at this time. I think it needs to be done. I think, for me anyway, this is all relatively new. The policy statement and the technical report from the Burton County Pediatrics came out at the end of 2012, so it was really 7 or 8 months ago. And then my interest became increased when I saw the bill and realized how close it was to the policy statement. So I went from being kind of a spectator on the side to becoming extremely interested.
And Dr. Seneff, how about for you? Do you, when you're doing these studies, like he's saying these studies need to be done, well, you're one of them who's doing studies.
Right, yes. We're working towards future studies that will be more decisive, because it's been the case that Roundup, people have been assured that Roundup is safe, so much so that the government doesn't bother to do studies to see if it's true. And so we are in the process of trying to design more. Our studies have all been reading the literature and interpreting it, which has been very, very, I think, quite compelling and quite promising. But you can't get there with just that. You have to actually demonstrate directly damage to humans, or at least damage to mice that would be very convincing that they're also getting something like autism. So we're trying to line up something like that, which is very difficult.
And how do we get a study over here to be happening on what's going on here?
I know. Well, a great thing to do would be a study here. I think a good idea would be to use some grassroots funding, because you can do sort of crowd-based funding for a project. If you can sort of pitch it on the web and then get people to donate $10, $20, and you get a lot of people.
Crowdsource funding. But is there a university like what you're working with? The challenge with University of Hawaii is they're so heavily funded by the industry.
Exactly.
It's really hard for anybody to give it credibility. Dr. Hector Valenzuela is doing a good job. He
yes.
does work for there. We also had Dr. Bill Steiner on here, who is a UH professor, who is very, very strongly, he's a geneticist from UH, very strongly in favor of Bill 2491, and him really highlighting the point that most of the scientists that work within these industries are more like engineers. They're engineers rather than geneticists to be really able to see what's going on here. And it seems that when we're hearing there's not enough study, there's not enough this, how do we get that done? You're saying crowdsource money.
Well, for money is one issue, because you're not going to get the funding from the industry, for example. And in many cases, it's hard to get the funding from the government as well. And many universities are so well funded by the industry, they're even reluctant to do the research. I'm trying to get people interested in MIT, and I think it's going to be very hard to do something like this.
Okay,
other people besides myself.
That's what I was really asking. Can you get MIT to do it, or can you do it?
Yes, I would be delighted to do it, but I don't know how to get the funding for it. So that goes back to the crowdsource funding. So when we're actually working on something like that, we're trying to work something out right now. Anthony and I are, and Anthony's a good resource too, because he studied toxic sites before. So he has some. Yeah, I don't have any tools like to measure things. I'm a computer scientist, so my whole thing is just reading and writing papers. I don't have facilities, so that would make it hard for me to set something up. But I would like to work with someone. There are people at MIT who are doing work with mice, and so if I could interest them, but I think that's going to be hard.
Well, I think that I lost a baby once, not actually too long ago, and The nurse in the doctor's office just kind of shrugged and said, oh, well, you know, everybody's been losing their babies this month. Like, it was no big deal. And I was like, oh, wow. And she said, oh, you know, once in a while that'll happen. And right now we've lost more than half of them.
Wow.
And I thought,
wow.
Does that get caught anywhere? Does the, Department of Health, what catches that to determine why those things happen?
You know, I think that's a very valid question, and what can be done relatively easily is collect our own health statistics.
Yes.
So we can collect by zip code what's happening in our communities. On the east side of the island, we have particularly robust electronic medical record system that the majority of the patients are in, and the diagnoses are entered. So we can tell what's happening in communities that are on the east side of Lawai, or all patients that are in our EPIC system, essentially.
I know.
My belief is that of interest to all of us would be to take a look at all of our communities and their illness rates, and particularly compare them to Waimea Ke Kaha.
I think that'd be great.
We hear all of this anecdotal evidence, essentially, that there's increased cancer rates, increased asthma, increased bleeding noses, epistaxis, we call it. But until you actually take that anecdotal evidence and turn it into real evidence, it doesn't have much credibility.
That's right.
But it would not be difficult, I don't think, to appoint a small commission, a committee of some sort that basically was empowered to collect that data. The cancer data should be in our registries, so we should be able to pick up most of the cancer data, and that at some place, even though it's not published by zip code, it's available by zip code. So I would think, I would hope that out of this whole Bill 2491, and one of the council members had mentioned it, comes the calling for a committee or some kind of organization that actually fairly rapidly attempts to collect this data. But I think very importantly is the aspects of 2491 are important, meaning buffer zones and right to know and so on. And I keep saying it, but I hope that the council doesn't take the approach that they want to collect the data and stall the bill.
Right.
They need to pass the pieces of it that are just common sense and are even being called for by the American Academy of Pediatrics. So I would hope that both happen simultaneously, that they actually call for the collection of the data that we have available to us. And I don't mean studies with placebo effect and so on. I'm talking about just looking at the raw data that we have on the
epidemiological.
Yes, that's what's being touted in so many venues, and we need to see how real it is.
And that would be great, because you figure this is the same island and everybody has the same, you know, a lot of similar things in common, so you wouldn't expect dramatic differences aside from that one factor. So it would really be a likely thing to show up.
Yes.
So we have a caller. Aloha, you are on the air.
Yes, I read a book called Honesty in Medicine, and they recommend this ketogenic diet, which is administered from John Hopkins University and also charliefoundation.org. In that case, because one famous person had a son that had pediatric epilepsy, and this diet takes care of such children without drugs.
I am aware of that, actually, and I endorse it. I think it is a very good way to treat epilepsy, to go on an extremely high-fat, low-carb diet. And especially, I think coconut is very viable for as a food source.
Okay.
And you have coconut here, so.
Even though if it's pesticide, that's a pretty heavy insult. So, but since you know about it.
Oops. Are you there? Hello? Sir? We might have lost him. Hello? You're on the air?
Aloha, Felicia.
Okay.
This is Lynn. I just had a thought when I listened to the testimony that was being given by some of the people for 2491. There was mentioned that some of the projects are to grow food crops for people in Africa, and that it's being funded by the Gates Foundation. So my question is, as to somebody writing grants and stuff like that, I really think you should hold the Gates Foundation's feet to the fire and ask for the money to examine the anecdotal evidence and to put it into case study format so that it can actually be used as part of the decision-making process.
Okay. All right.
Now, it's a serious thought, because if they supposedly are thinking that they're doing something that's going to be really helpful, and it looks as if what they're doing is actually harmful because of non-containment and things like that, then I think then you've got somebody on your side that's got a little bit more money. Anyhow. Okay, aloha.
Okay, thank you so much. Okay, we have one more call. You're on the air.
Well, I was talking earlier.
I'm sorry you got disconnected. Thank you for calling back.
But I pretty much threw us what I had to say, because I don't know very much.
But she was responding.
Yes, no, I think that is a great idea. I think that a lot of times there's a problem with glucose metabolism in the brain, and you can actually get other... People think the brain has to have only sugar for fuel, and that's not true at all. And in fact, if you have a ketogenic diet, it introduces things called ketone bodies, which the neurons are very happy to use as fuel.
Tell us what a ketogenic diet is.
High fat. Very
so
high fat.
So that would mean butter?
Like 90%. It's like... maybe 90% fat and 10% protein and 0% carb. You want to try to move towards that
possibility. So are you saying eat ice cream?
Yes, eating. You're eating, you know, what would it be? Very fatty meats, you know, bacon, for example. And, yeah, ice cream, whipped cream.
Whipped cream,
butter,
but probably not ice cream.
Butter. Ice cream's got too much sugar. Butter, yeah, no sugar ice cream. Well, and also, I don't like the non-sugar sweeteners, so that's a little bit of a problem. But, full fat sour cream. Oh, that's got lactate, which is probably okay. You sort of want to avoid sugar and carbohydrates, and eating bacon and eggs. Bacon and eggs would be great, actually. And as I said, coconut oil.
I wanted to ask you, with a lot of the babies are in my family, when they're born, they're not able to drink regular milk.
Wow.
Like your milk, they can't drink your milk.
Okay. They cannot drink my milk, and they can only drink soy milk.
Wow.
So I'm wondering, you know, if some of that has anything to do with it. It's kind of, actually, I'm now lactose intolerant, which I've never been my whole entire life. And after having my son, I became lactose intolerant.
Wow, that's interesting. That's causing
so there's a lot of complex things here. And so just like in fairness to the people spraying the poison, it's a little bit like they'd go, well, lot of issues. I can see why they can't necessarily nail it down to one thing. I know that they're like... Nathan, your nieces were two of the kids who ended up having seizures. Is that correct? Am I remembering that correctly? And the middle school problem at Waimea Canyon?
It's actually her two cousins.
Okay, so Randy, it was your family.
Once again, my family. I have two baby cousins that actually graduated this year. Both of them were kids that were affected by the stinkweed. Quotations. They had a numerous amount of kids were saying their eyes were burning, dizziness, sickness. It was all in the paper. Everybody saw
it.
Right.
There was 11 people who went into distress, I think, that day. But it might be that people have seizure thresholds. I know that Eric, as we've been trying to figure out what's happened for him recently, where he's had some. There might be different seizure thresholds, and maybe that can be somewhat genetic, and then being hit with a stimulus. I'm asking Dr. Evslin or Dr. Seneff. I don't know.
I'm wondering the same thing. The two girls, by the way, did not have seizures. They just got sick.
They just got... Okay,
yes.
They weren't seizures.
But I am wondering the same thing about seizures threshold and...
For sure, there are seizure thresholds, and different stimuli set off seizures in people that have a predilection in that direction, and those thresholds can be changed by stress, and or they can be reached more easily by things like stress, lack of sleep, flashing lights, and so on. So the answer would be I really don't know if pesticides change that threshold. My guess would be yes, it would be an irritant like anything else. And again, until you've kind of put all the data together, you're only just guessing.
Go ahead.
There isn't any doubt that acute exposure to a pesticide in terms of poisonings cause seizures. So if you know that acute exposures can, you certainly can extrapolate that from that chronic exposures could have similar effects. And that is what the American Academy of Pediatrics was saying, is we don't know enough about this chronic exposure. The data is getting increasingly scary in that these chronic effects are real. But we need to collect this data. And they're really pushing communities like us to, one, do the things that they talk about, such as buffers, but two, collect your data. Take a look at it. We need to find out what's going on in the communities that are being exposed.
Since my seizures first began in January, I've been doing a lot of research on them and the different causes for them, and it's so hard for you to find an exact cause. Why am I having a seizure? You know, I've been vigorously researching it for the past 6 months, and they can't find a definite cause. I mean, going through Wilcox, you can't say anything bad against them. You know, the community hospital, I can't blame them for not being able to find anything as to why I'm having seizures. But it's in these growing countries, you know, the ones that are the furthest ahead with technology that are having this disorders pop up more and more, such as autism, seizures, you know, biggest disorders and newest diseases that are appearing in humans.
Are in which countries?
The most developed countries.
Most
in the world.
Developed countries.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, with my seizures, just trying to figure out the exact cause, you know, I would like to be able to say, oh, it's because of the pesticides and put all my focus on there. But it's trying to say, even theoretically or especially legally in court, to say, you're the cause I'm having seizures is, with the money they got backing them, it's a pretty hard battle to win.
I think that's why this bill is so important, mm-hmm. the right to know. You know what I mean? We have a right to be able to make some sort of a coalition or whatever to, you know, somebody fund these guys that they can actually do some sort of experimenting and find out if these pesticides are actually doing the things that they're doing or that people are accusing, or if they're not even accusing. I mean, we live, you know, on both sides of Waimea. Mm-hmm. You know, there's fields, and, you know, I've witnessed, you know, pesticides being sprayed.
Yeah.
You know, and I've actually, when I was going to school, you know, in high school, I worked seasonal for Syngenta, you know, mm-hmm. and the thing about it is, you know, can that, me working a couple of months, you know, or not even a month actually, winter break, you know, in school, can that be enough for X amount of years down the road for me to impregnate my wife and she has a kid and ends up having something happen? I think we have a right to know that.
It's,
you know?
It's a right for you to know, but, you know, we have to be asking these questions and we have to have answers to it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They know that these are possibilities. And for people to say that, oh, this is misinformation, you misguided fears, and people are just kind of freaking out and looking for something to complain about, is just ridiculous. It's an insult. We need to figure out these answers, and definitely Bill 2491 is a step in the right direction. Definitely the right to know is the biggest key to succeeding in anything I think we have on this island.
And Dr. Stephanie Seneff, S-E-N-E-F-F.
That's right.
Can you please give your email address? We've had a couple calls wanting to know that.
Okay. Seneff at CSAIL, C-S-A-I-L, dot M-I-T dot E-D-U.
So S-E-N-E-F-F, like Frank.
Right.
At?
Seneff at, yes, CSAIL dot M-I-T dot E-D-U.
So
C-S-A-I-L, C and then a SAIL. Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory.
Okay, thank you.
And I did want to say something again about the science, because I have been, as I said, studying autism for a long time, and one of the things I identified was a severe deficiency in sulfate. They have only about maybe one quarter as much sulfate, free sulfate in the blood as their control in the measurements, kids. And so I looked into sulfate intensively. And I wrote a paper about encephalitis, which an encephalitis is often associated with seizures. And the paper was about a mechanism that the body has a very complex cascade reaction. And lots of things happen. All kinds of crazy things are happening in the brain. But if you look at what it would be doing biochemically, you can see that it would achieve producing sulfate in the brain from taurine. And you would need seizures as an energy source to do that. So, in other words, there's a motivation for why the seizures are needed to produce the sulfate that the brain desperately needs to protect from the bleeding. And so we wrote this paper before I knew anything about glyphosate hooking up to autism. Then when we looked at glyphosate, we realized that what it does directly relates to sulfate deficiency. So we could connect glyphosate to the problem of the sulfate deficiency, and we could connect the sulfate deficiency problem to the seizures, which are also associated with autism. So that's just kind of an example of connecting the dots.
Mm-hmm.
Just a comment on what was being said about wanting to know. One of the strongly worded paragraphs in this American Academy policy statement was that we need to mandate that the government require that we find more biomarkers for poisonings. We don't really have them. We have... For organophosphates, we can measure red blood cell substances that are decreased in the poisoning, but we don't have much at our disposal to test somebody and say, okay, you have this. Mm-hmm. There are tests, there are urine tests and blood tests that can measure levels, but they haven't been correlated with much that's considered very valid. And they are calling for us to develop just this testing, that we need to know. This has become part of our environment in so many ways. We need to be able to test. And it's even, you know, as I thought about this mandate that they were requiring, I was thinking in our studying on Kauai, it might be very interesting, which I know has been done to some degree in the school systems, but to be testing blood and urine of children in Kanaale and children in Waimea and seeing what we're seeing just in the levels. It doesn't necessarily tell you anything. It's just collecting data.
Mm-hmm.
But that data becomes very powerful as you put it together.
Right. I think it would be great to be able to do that. And, of course, that takes money, and that's where.
Right.
So I have another caller who's been patiently holding. Aloha. You're on the air.
Hi. Everything you guys were talking about is very interesting. I was born in the 50s, and both my parents were agricultural workers in the pineapple industry in Oahu. And then when I think I was the age of 3 to 4 years old, I had seizures.
Mm.
So they never pertained it to chemicals or anything like that. They just accepted it, and then I outgrew it. But I believe it's because of the chemicals they used in the pineapple industry, and when we moved, that's when I became healthier.
So you outgrew it by moving away?
I guess so. And then, you know, I'm afraid of it. You know, I was always afraid of it coming back, but it never came back throughout my adult life. And I changed my diet and so forth, became a vegetarian at one point. And now I eat a lot of fatty foods. Awesome. You know, but I eat meat and fish and stuff like that, but because of Fukushima, I'm worried about that. So, but our ahi don't migrate into the Japanese waters, but, you know, still our oceans. You know. Anyway, there's so many topics to talk about, but to stick on this topic, I appreciate what the doctors are talking about. So sulfate is a very important part of our diet.
Sulfur, yes. Sulfur deficiency, I think, is a huge problem in the modern diet.
So what would you suggest as far as taking sulfate on a daily basis?
So sulfate itself is actually kind of tricky, and so it requires your body to make it, but it needs to. You need to eat things that contain sulfur but not sulfate, and then the sulfur has to be made. Sulfate has to be made by the body. It's tricky. And
so part what of contains sulfur?
Eggs, for example, are a very good source. Garlic, onions, cruciferous vegetables like broccoli and cauliflower. Cabbage, onions, I said onions, seafood, oysters, for example, shrimps, all the shellfish are good sources, and fish itself, meat. So basically high animal.
The caller mentioned Fukushima, which I think is a really interesting point, caller, because I keep being inundated with the stuff from high credible sources like E! News, They don't build it up much, but Fukushima continues to be melting down and melting through and dumping incredible wastewater into the ocean day after day after day. And so it's hard to know, like, where are we getting bombarded with so many different elements? And so she's saying this shellfish, which I almost won't even eat anymore because of the BP oil spill, and then, you know,
I know
what's going on. You know, where's it coming from? You know, I even hardly eat fish anymore.
Yeah, it's very tough because often the thing, in fact, liver would be really good for you, but liver is almost impossible to eat anymore because it's where the toxins are accumulate. Liver is a very, very healthy food with enormous amounts of nutritional value. But it's going to have those toxins in it.
And these dark leafy green vegetables are so good because they pull up all the minerals, but they pull the bad ones up right along with the good ones.
I know. They could have the aluminum.
They have all of that in there, the lead and the arsenic. They pull it all up.
It's hard. It's really hard. I mean, that's maybe part of why sulfur is deficient. Actually, sulfur deficiency arises in the plants because of their exposure to the toxic chemicals. So it starts with the diet. The food you're eating is already sulfur deficient compared to what it should be.
So do you think supplements with sulfur in it is very good for your body system?
Yeah, there's one thing that I do and I recommend, which is Epsom salt baths. That's a really easy thing to do. It's like going to a sulfur hot springs, and you basically just, you can buy these very easily at the grocery store even. You just dump it into the bath water, make a hot bath, and soak. So that's a really easy way to get sulfate, actually, because that's magnesium sulfate absorbed through the skin, which then gets past all the difficulties of making the sulfate.
So would there be any danger in them trying that with their son?
I think they definitely should try it. It's non-toxic. I've read that there hasn't been any evidence of harm with Epsom salt baths.
So do you think swimming in the ocean is...
Excellent, actually. Swimming in the ocean is excellent. The ocean actually has hydrogen sulfide gas, which you can also get sulfur from that.
Perfect. Awesome. So many topics to talk about. I wanted to also address the shooting that just occurred. I heard about it today, and one of my coworkers... I'm sorry to change the subject.
Well, can you hold that thought? It's the top of the hour, so let me acknowledge the top of the hour, and then you'll be able to share that. Okay?
Okay, I'll hold. Thank you.
Okay.
You are listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K284AL, Haleiwa.
Okay, caller, you had a point about the shooting?
Yeah, I want to just say prayers to the family. I'm sorry that happened to the young man, and that I'm sorry it came to that, because, you know, police officers are people, too, and they have families, and so they're just trying to protect themselves. But,
yeah.
You know, it's just appalling that these things come to our small island, but that's just the world. So, but, you know, I just had a coworker that knew the person, so it just kind of was very shocking to me just to know that it just happened, you know, just the other day in Beverly Hills. So, but these things do happen, and we just have to just educate ourselves on safety, you know, definitely. And, you know, I mean, I think people should have freedom of owning guns or doing whatever they want to do, but in a safe manner if they're knowledgeable. And it's a difficult line to, you know, to talk about, but, you know, it's just being human is very sensitive, you know. And, you know, just even the topic of the seizures and then the GMO, I just drove by the guys that were... for GMO, I guess, the workers, they're right across the street from the mall today in Lihue, with signs that saying it's safe. So, you know, so it's just perfect to talk to you guys on the phone. It's a very, we're very lucky we have the station, so I'm just going to get off there. But thanks for bringing the doctors, you know, people that are professional that, you know, are very aware of all this stuff. And it's just very educational to have your show. Appreciate it. Mahalo.
Mahalo, thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you.
Aloha. You're welcome. We have another patient caller. Aloha, you're on the air.
Aloha. I wanted to ask Dr. Stephanie if she would share again. I heard her briefly on another show about what the chemical actions of the
glyphosate. That's such a hard word. Everyone has trouble pronouncing it.
Glyphosate,
yes.
Are in the body that you're,
yes,
you're referencing.
Good.
And I'm,
yes,
going to go off. I'm going to go off the air and listen.
Okay. Great.
Okay.
Yes, there's several different effects that it has, and of course it. It's Monsanto says it's not harmful to us because we don't have the pathway that it disrupts in the plants, which is called the shikimate pathway. But our gut bacteria, all of them, have this pathway. And this pathway is really, really important to them for producing essential amino acids that we depend upon them for. So when the bacteria don't make those amino acids, we get deficient in them. And these are called the aromatic amino acids. And they are precursors to really important molecules in the body like serotonin and dopamine and melatonin and melanin. All of these things depend upon these amino acids that the bacteria are supposed to make for us. So if they can't make those precursors, then we don't get enough of those very, very important molecules. So, for example, serotonin deficiency is associated with a great number of different diseases and conditions that are that are becoming more prevalent today.
Such as?
Autism, obesity, Alzheimer's disease, and depression, and violent behavior. All of these things are related to low serotonin. And low dopamine is associated with Parkinson's disease. So these are things that we really depend upon for that, for the health of our brain and our nervous system. Another factor is that they chelate important minerals such as calcium, magnesium, iron, manganese, cobalt. Cobalt is very, very important for the B vitamin cobalamin, and cobalamin deficiency is also associated with autism and with a number of other conditions that we have today. Recently, I've been studying celiac disease, and I'm convinced that glyphosate is playing a role in that as well. That's the gluten intolerance, and we're seeing gluten intolerance all over the place lately with the gluten-free, springing up in all the grocery stores.
I have a alternative middle school, and I have 26 students. Five of them are gluten intolerant.
Wow, that's amazing.
I wanted to say, you just named four diseases that are in my family that live right across in the same house. We have my aunt who has Parkinson's.
Wow.
I have my great-grandmother who we take care of who has Alzheimer's. I have obesity. My son has seizures. I mean, every single thing that you're naming off of here is freaking me out.
Wow.
It literally is making it so sad because I am thinking about our family, our friends that work for the corn companies and everything, and I just still don't understand why they won't give us the right to know this information. You're naming these things that are directly hurting, affecting our family directly. It's amazing. It's just blowing my mind right now.
Wow. I'm sorry. Dr. Ebslin, if you have patients, when somebody comes in with an issue like this, if there was on the right to know, if they said, I live, and they give you an address like this family here, and they were able to show, or you were able to look up online what the spray records were, would that influence your estimate of what's going on as a doctor?
You know, I don't think yet. I think let me answer that in two ways. Of course, it would be a piece of evidence in a puzzle, and we would look at that puzzle and say this may be playing a role. I think we have to be somewhat cautious in putting all the data together in terms of saying for sure that's what it is. Of interest, I've sent two children to Capilani in the last 6 months. One was a small baby who stopped breathing, and they had been spraying the household with a lot of pesticides, which the mother mentioned, and was worried that maybe it played a role. And when I mentioned it to the staff at Capilani as part of the workup, they were kind of, it didn't get particularly done, and part in terms of a workup other than to some degree investigate what pesticide was used. And another child went recently, and we were worried about organophosphate poisoning, and that got tested sometime later in the admission. And it isn't, the problem is, as this article points out, us pediatricians are woefully ignorant on this subject. This is just being brought into our attention as a problem. And when I hear the workers saying that they're using safe practices, what I know is that we don't know enough about safe practices. We don't know yet the full toxicity of these things. So we don't really know what a safe practice is, and that makes me nervous. And it was the gist of the article, basically, is we plain don't know enough. The evidence is growing that there's a problem here.
Mm-hmm.
And scientists like you are finding this stuff in the frontiers, basically.
Right.
But those frontier science, in a way, needs to come back to the mainstream, which is all of us.
Right.
And I'm embarrassed, but I've now had 3 months of major interest in this subject, not more than that. And I've been a physician for a long time. So what I guess I'm saying is I admit to my ignorance on the subject, and I think it behooves all of us that are involved in this to become smarter quickly. And it means that we need to learn more.
I know.
Yeah, I want to acknowledge that. Like, really, without all the pressure from the listeners, I wouldn't have looked at this deeply. And my strong opinion is a year old. And how long have I been exposed to it? I just haven't taken the time and haven't wanted to have something to humbug over. And it's easier to go, well, they seem to know what they're doing. Somebody better than me knows. And if it was bad, well, they wouldn't let this happen. But it seems like that's what a lot of people are doing. We do have another caller, so I'm going to take this. Aloha, you're on the air.
Aloha. Hi, Felicia. It's Christy.
Hi, Christy.
I'm so grateful and blessed to have Dr. Ebslin and Dr. Senna on the program. And I just wanted to say that after just hearing what you said, I became involved in the GMO issue back in 2003 when I had been healthy my whole entire life and never gotten sick, and all of a sudden I got Crohn's disease, and I was sick constantly and couldn't figure out what was going on with me, and I was you know, I bought the packaged foods here and there. I was working a lot. And so when I finally did realize what was wrong and the doctors, you know, wanted to, like, do surgery or put me on drugs, and I wasn't going to go for that, I did my own research and then found a doctor who told me that our food system had been changed. And so one of the reasons why I'm so big into this fight is because I know a lot about it. And I'm so sorry for the family on the West Side, and I would really like to say that probiotics help a whole lot into bringing good bacteria and into their lives. And if they could bring a probiotic system into their lives, that it would really do a great amount of good for them. But and I also agree with Dr. Sinek that what I had to do was get off of the you know, the GMO packaged food system and all of that, and go to a more fatty diet with also included in all with organic greens. Mm. So bacon and eggs are wonderful, and salad is wonderful. It all works, and I don't get sick. But the minute I try to eat pasta or ragu, I have major problems. But probiotics work, and I'm just hoping that we can pass some sort of bill that gives us a right to know for these children, because these kids didn't have this back 30 years ago. Our kids weren't being exposed to this kind of stuff. Yeah, maybe a little here and there with the sugarcane fields and a little atrazine here and there, but nothing compared to what is happening today. It seems to me that it's 1,000 times worse, and if we don't get a hold of what the data is, then how are we going to ever find out? Anyway, that's all I wanted to say, and thank you so much, both of you, and all of you, and you, Felicia, too.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think I agree a lot with what she had to say. You know, growing up, you know, you're going to school and, you know, not to be discriminating or hating on anybody, but, you know, growing up, you see, you know, X amount of kids that seem to be normal, and then you see X amount of other kids that might be in special ed or have some kind of problem or, you know, mental retardation or whatever you want to call it. But nowadays, I almost don't know anybody who has had a kid within the last 10 years that has came out completely normal or who hasn't had anything wrong with them.
Is that right? That's a high
incredible
percentage.
The amount of kids on the West Side that are getting asthma, that are getting so-called allergies, where I have a nephew tonight who cannot breathe, just cannot breathe. And he cries with Flonase, asking to have that, asking for anything, strips, anything to make him breathe.
Yeah.
I have the amount of miscarriages that are going on, the amount of just the crazy sheer amount of kids that are in special ed for things like ADHD and ADD and autism. And PDD on a West isn't necessarily your typical form of autism that you see with like a typical autistic child. They're on the low end spectrum of autism, and they're definitely able to talk and walk and do things, but they have their problem learning and they have certain traits of autism. And it's scary because more and more kids are contracting autism, contracting ADHD, ADD, the special education system. I mean, there's so many children. I'm just not understanding why. Mm-hmm. And how do we fix it? What are we supposed to do?
Do you have statistics on that, Stephanie?
Well, definitely all of these things are going up, ADHD and autism and asthma and Crohn's disease and this gluten intolerance. I mean, all of these digestive problems are all showing up in alarming increases in these things. Also, depression and Alzheimer's disease is going up. I mean, all of these things are going up. This is what was so surprising to me when I saw how I could connect it to glyphosate and to think, you know, maybe that's a huge part of the problem. And of course, glyphosate, I didn't mention this, but glyphosate works synergistically with the other toxins because it disrupts the enzymes. This is another thing that it does, disrupts the enzymes in the body that detoxify the other toxins. So if you're exposed to Roundup and something else, then the something else is going to be worse because of the Roundup.
And glyphosate is not something that is affected at all by 2491.
Only indirectly, and I was really glad to know that it was affected.
How is it affected? Because it's not a restricted use pesticide.
Yes, Gary explained this to me, that if you've qualified because you are using more than this limit of the restricted pesticides, then you have to report on your usage, you know, to give all of this information, when, where, what, on everything, including the glyphosate. So at least you would have accountability.
So say that one more time, because I didn't get that. Tell me that one more time. If you're using all these restricted use pesticides
above that limit,
then you have to just, like, show your whole hand of cards.
That's right. You have to show the glyphosate as well. And it turns out the glyphosate, by the way, is huge. These companies are using, I think, four times as much glyphosate as everything else put together. It's really the elephant in the room, in my opinion.
Yeah, my dad has told me before, who's a certified pesticide applicator, and he doesn't do it now, but he's told me that on this island, what these companies are doing is like 15 times more than what is supposed to be put out on the label.
You're basically a child of the industry, right? You grew up in a household supported by the industry, is that?
No.
But your father worked there.
For, I would say, about 2 years.
Okay.
If I can remember correctly. But,
okay.
Just, like, he worked in the county in Honolulu from the 70s and retired over there, and we moved over here to start a farm, you know, and so he has all kinds of different
skills and things.
Yeah, that he had to acquire being working there. So that's how he knows a lot about. He actually didn't spray working for Pioneer. But he did spray working for Nokoi plants afterwards.
And the same kind of heavy chemicals, or more like Roundup?
I'm not too sure on what chemicals.
And you just explained how Roundup is the elephant in the room, and I'm not lightweighting that. Like, one thing I hope that happens as a result of all these conversations, I like how the State Department of Transportation has stopped using Roundup on the sides of the highway. Particularly anywhere near the culverts and things like that. We used to just see it just blasted everywhere. That people start finding a different tool to use in their own yards. I don't use it. I know my next door neighbor does. I asked him to stop putting it on along my fence line. He did, and then I have to send somebody over there to clean the weeds off of his side, or my overgrowth, because I do have abundance coming out of my space.
You know, and that's a good thing you brought up just now, with roadside spraying. You know, Waimea Valley, you got the riverbank on one side, and everybody's house is right across the street. And these guys, we've watched them for many years spray Roundup.
That's the Department of Transportation or the houses?
I would say Kauai County.
Kauai County, okay.
Yeah.
And they admit that they're still using it.
And the thing about it is they don't need to do that. You know, I have more friends and fingers on my hands who own horses that would just love to have their horses grazing on this grass that grows on that riverbank. You know, why do we have to spray that?
Such easy solutions within reach, and we're not using them.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have two callers. Aloha, you're on the air.
Aloha. I just wanted to reflect a point that was in there. If the glyphosate compromises the enzymes that break down other pesticides, as far as I'm aware, the process of adaptation for the seed that the chemical companies are growing, they're putting many, many chemicals on at the same time, which not only creates chemical compounds that they have no idea what's going to happen, but if the glyphosate reduces our ability to deal with those pesticides, it actually makes exposure to all those other pesticides that they're putting on their seed to adapt them much, much worse.
Yes, I could comment on that. I'm extremely concerned about what I suspect is the research here to add resistance to another pesticide on top of the resistance to Roundup into the core crops that will then go into things like corn and soy. I think once we have resistance, for example, to dicamba and glyphosate, or to, you know, these various other atrazine and glyphosate or something like that, you're going to get a really, really dangerous situation with both of these chemicals on the residues in the food, in the food that's in the core processed food industry. I think it's going to be really scary.
I think something else I'd like to mention is something I read today on GMO crops is that 15 years down the line from their first applications in the 90s, now they're finding that there's massive resistance and that there's been adaptation in the insects. And they were all proud of themselves that it took 15 years for some of them to bounce back. But they're pretty much admitting, like, this is no long-term solution in terms of pests. This is only just going to be an ongoing roller coaster of more poison to deal with pests that are, you know, insects that are adapting to it. So
and weeds, too, yes.
Yeah, it's not a solution in any kind of way.
It kind of sounds like a chemical arms race.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so thank you for getting the information out there.
Okay, thank you. I have another caller. Aloha, you're on the air.
I was wondering if there is an effort underway or a way to educate some of the doctors on Kauai and also on the other islands who may not be aware of pesticide toxicity and exposure and the symptoms. When I was on the mainland and I was pregnant with my first son, I lived across from genetically modified cornfields that were sprayed with aerial spraying constantly. And my son was born with an endocrine disorder. And then when I lived in Wisconsin, I lived near University of Wisconsin-Madison GMO test field. And there was a flood, and it washed toxic mud through our community. We, as well as several other families, directly adjacent to the lake that drained, got very, very sick. And, you know, we had to go all the way to, you know, a scientist that works with the EPA on cleaning up toxic sites to try to find out what was going on. And we were diagnosed exposure to biohazardous nanomaterials / genetically modified organisms. Now, when I moved to Kauai hoping that this would help me in the healing process, I went through a phase where I was having a lot of seizures. And I was having tremors. My hands were shaking. Sometimes I could only walk to the left. I couldn't walk straight. It was completely debilitating and scary.
And you sound young. And how old are you?
I'm 40, 42.
Okay.
So I got a referral to a neurologist here on Kauai. He was at Wilcox. I'm not going to say his name. I don't want to embarrass him publicly or anything, but when I went to see this neurologist at Wilcox, you know, on the day that I went to see him, I was having shakes, obviously. My hands were shaking. I was obviously walking to the left. I couldn't walk straight. Was explaining the seizures and my medical history with pesticide exposure. The only other thing I'd had in my past was about with Lyme disease, but I had been diagnosed with lupus recently.
Mm.
And just, you know, please help me. I don't know what's going on. I'm scared. I can't walk straight sometimes. I'm having seizures. And he looked at me, and he kind of smiled, and he said, "Do you have a boyfriend?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, I found that, you know, women of your age with these types of symptoms usually see them clear up once they start having more orgasms." And I was stunned, and I started crying, and, you know, basically left the office in complete tears. I felt like I was victimized all over again. And I just feel like there needs to be an effort to educate doctors, you know, as to some of these symptoms, because I later found a really great doctor here in Kauai. He's very comprehensive and very aware of toxicity with pesticides and autoimmune disorders. But that experience was so traumatizing, I didn't go to a doctor for a long time.
You don't have trust in the Wilcox system any further?
Wow.
Wow.
Just a comment on that piece. The in this, again, in the technical report and the policy statement, one of the bits of research they had done was to go to academic centers and to pediatricians of all sorts and find out what kind of level of knowledge we had on the subject. And they reported quite straightforward that the level of knowledge is very low. Mm. It's not point of mind. It's not top of mind, basically. We're not thinking about it. We don't have the knowledge base. And not only don't we have the knowledge base, we don't really even have the tools that are accepted tools anyway in the so-called allopathic world for testing as biomarkers. There are tests out there, but they're not fully accepted as being markers of what's going on.
And caller, are you still on the air?
Yes.
Okay, all right. Okay.
So your point is very well taken. The knowledge base in the average allopathic physician is not high. And they pointed this out and said it was one of the things we need to remedy.
And I just wanted to say to you, I'm really, really sorry that you had that experience. And I know that those things do happen. I had a bad reaction once to a prescribed medicine, and I felt like ridiculed in the cardiologist's office. And it is so hard, and to wait, and like when I made an appointment, and I was having like blackouts, and they call it panic disorder. I wasn't having a panic disorder. I was like, it turns out that medicine is really prescribed for epilepsy, and it's called Topamax. And then when I looked it up on askapatient.com or something, you see that like so many people have these radical reactions to it. But I was like having blackouts for about 9 weeks. But by the time I finally got an appointment, which was almost 3 months later, I'd kind of healed. But through doing Ayurvedics, I'm going to give a shout out to the pharmacist at North Shore Pharmacy. Martha, I think is her name. She was like giving me all this other stuff to do that was not straight medicine. And it worked. And it happened over, a period of time. But by the time I finally got to the doctor, he literally laughed at me till he made me cry. Then the nurses comforted me when he left the room. And he said, he's just too busy. He's got too many patients. And sorry. Mm-hmm. But those things happen. And I'm not trying to diss on the doctors. I'm just trying to not have you get off the air having shared a story that is a painful story to share and feel like we just go, oh, okay, got it. You know, I hear you, and I'm sorry for what you've gone through.
Well, my concern is that other people on the island who are experiencing perhaps neurological symptoms from pesticide exposure are not getting the help they need or the documentation they need from some members in the medical community who just aren't educated about this.
With the way our medical... Oh, I'm sorry, continue.
Yeah, I'm done.
Okay, I was just going to say, with the way our medical system is set up, the only way we're going to know this is a really big problem is by the time it's too late. And that, you know, it's... A lot of people seem to be suffering from these random disorders such as seizures, and there's definitely a cause somewhere, and I don't think our medical system, or no offense to Wilcox, but I don't think they're going to be able to figure out the root cause of this problem by themselves.
We need to help them.
Agreed. Mm-hmm.
So thank you, caller.
Thank you.
And let's wait. Okay.
I have to get going. I'm training for another jiu-jitsu tournament, so I got to go to my jiu-jitsu class. One little side topic that I wanted to bring up, international news. Germany has requested its gold back from the Federal Reserve, and they have 1,500 tons of gold in the Federal Reserve right now, equal to $64 billion. And the U.S. has always been a safe place to keep your gold, everyone thinks. But since 2007, they've been trying to get a look at the gold that is theirs, but the Federal Reserve's in 2011 let them see one of the 9 vaults containing all their gold, and now they're over it and they want all their gold back from Paris and the U.S. And I know, interesting to see what things come of that, because as people start to lose their security in the U.S. and the Federal Reserve, more people start taking out their gold, things will happen. Anyways, just wanted to bring that up.
It's a very big issue and a very important one and a really interesting one. You are listening to KKCR Hanalei KAQA Kilauea. Good luck in your jiu-jitsu tournament in Las Vegas, and I worry I don't want you to get your head hit. I think that has something to do with...
I gotta say, that is so irritating. Like, that...
about the seizures?
Kind of what you just said right there. Like, having seizures, and there's so many different causes for it, and having to talk to every single person that knows and loves me and explaining the situation, and then for them to ask just, did you hit your head?
Well,
did you see too many flashing lights? I mean, that's what everyone kind of thinks. You know,
we had Michael Majoris die recently from a seizure, and he did hit his head pretty hard a couple years earlier, and there was a corollary, and I care very much. And
I know, it's just
love out to his family who've lost their 25-year-old son. And
anyways, I won't be hitting my head anytime soon. Thanks,
okay,
Alicia.
Please don't hit your
head.
Aloha, you guys.
Grappling, right?
Okay, you're listening to KKCR. Aloha, you're on the air.
Hi. Just to say that this is not a local problem. We are, according to my inadequate mathematics, making enough seed corn on this island for between 5 and 10 million acres, all of which need to be sprayed wherever they are being seeded out. Anyway, good luck with that.
Wow. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and that's one thing with their corn. It's like, why are we trying to make these plants and grow things that are required to spray chemicals on them in order for them to grow? You know?
Yeah, it's crazy.
I don't understand that way of thinking.
We're at that time of the show when we get all kinds of people lining up. So I got my next caller. Aloha, you're on the air. Hello?
Aloha, is that me?
Yes, it is.
All right. Hey, Mahalo for you guys getting the show on the air and getting the awareness up. This is Keone Keloa calling in. I just wanted to call. Hey, how you guys doing?
Good. And I think you got a solution or something moving in the direction.
Well, one of them. You know, there's not any single solution, but, you know, it's good to say what we don't want, and it's also good to put actions forward creating a future of things we do want, you know? And so on one of the solution sides is, I think, is not using pesticides or not using poisons in order to grow food. So, you know, we don't have any petroleum on our island, so we shouldn't be using petroleum-based fertilizer if we want to keep it local and be sustainable. So one of the efforts that's being put forth right now is to provide an island-wide organic training for people who are interested in learning how to grow local food organically. And I've been working with an organization for the past 7 years, and for the past three we've been working with Kauai schools with the Kauai School Garden Network program. And so at this point we've got enough school gardens that are installed and are activated that we've got now kind of a community-based site at different places around the island where we can host training. And so the idea is that to host these organic training classes at school gardens after school and on the weekend, so that parents and teachers and residents of our local communities have better access to the knowledge that they might need in order to grow food pesticide and petroleum free.
Okay, so is there a date or anything for anybody to be looking at?
Yeah, there's. We're kind of doing a quick push right now. We have an opportunity to get some funding, and the funding is an extension to a grant that we had for the School Garden Network, and we have just until the end of this month, August 31st. So I just wanted to throw out the URL to our website. If people are interested, they could check it out. On the homepage, there's a link, and people can find out more information about how they could support it. Basically, it's a matching grant, so we're not able to attain any of that funding unless we can get a grant from the community. And so the idea is, you know, if we all help out a little bit, just like we do with the fund drives at KKCR, that we can all reap the benefit. So
wonderful. So what's the URL?
The URL is malamakauai.org, as it sounds, malamakauai.org, malamakauai.org. So people are welcome to check that out. If you don't have access to the internet for some reason, you're welcome to give a call to our office line, which is 828-0685.
Okay, thank you for all the wonderful things that you do.
All right.
All right.
Me as well.
All right. Take care.
Aloha.
Aloha. Aloha, you're on the air.
My turn?
It is. Thank you for holding.
Hey, right on. Good show. Two points coming out. I really liked the guy's comment before. He said the seed companies are just generating more seeds that take more pesticides to make it work. And, you know, that says it in a nutshell, man. I mean, we don't want that. So,
never mind
that it doesn't feed our island, you know, all this experiments they're doing out there doesn't. But it also perpetuates mad science, is like spraying more Roundup, spraying more stuff. And I don't want to see that happen. And we got to stand up against that.
Yep.
My last comment would be, I didn't know the kid that was shot, but I don't dig that stuff, man. And if he didn't shoot his gun, then those cops used excessive force. And God bless his family. And you young kids, probably none of you are listening, but, you know, think before you do stupid stuff. Aloha.
Aloha.
Turn on, Meta.
Aloha, you're on the air.
Just a call is here, it goes out to the street.
Can you move yourself so you have a stronger connection? It's breaking up a lot. Are you able to hear me?
Hello?
Hello?
I'm sorry.
You were breaking up a lot. I can hear you some now. Try again.
Okay. I'm going to pull over. I'm going to Lydgate, the meeting at Lydgate. One of the things that I think confuses the issue is the use of the term science and data. Because in big science and university settings, it seems as if one of the key goals is to isolate a variable and have that be contributable to the disease. And what I want to ask the two doctors on the show, or just throw it on the table, is this issue is so complex because you talk about, rather than the companies say Roundup is safe, but it's based on testing Roundup. But it's the totality of the situation that's problematic. And Roundup has surfactants in it. The genetically engineered food has five or six extra components in it, including all protein synthesis. If you take a collection of drugs and give them to a human, you get multiple interactions. One, and a lot of them are inflammatory in nature. So a lot of the diseases will start to occur before high doses are reached. And I think that it's purposeful that we're talking about the data's not there. I think that's planted by the drug company's mantra, because the data is for an isolated ingredient. And this is 10 different ingredients with synergistic activities and a lot of processes that create diseases that we don't know. And in science, there's two types. A lot of times there's the early adopters that see a problem and try to seek a solution before data is there. That's how advancements made. But a lot of the sciences fall in the category of reading the data once it's made. And I think that the caller, two callers before the young woman, I think what she faced was someone who doesn't understand. I'm not trying to be disrespectful in this, but we have to understand that what are believed to be safe, acceptable doses may not be when you have six or seven things working in combination. And that's why it's important to have 2491 go through, so that there's an awareness. People can start looking for things that happen at very subtle levels with disclosure and awareness.
And that's the point that we were making, is that the data is here on Kauai. Or maybe here on Kauai, or it's been said to be here on Kauai, meaning we're looking at multiple causes with results, meaning ill health, and we need to take a look at that ill health, how it spreads itself around this island. And learn from it. So we are able to take multiple inputs as potential problems and see what the actual result is in humans. And so what we're talking about here is collecting data to look at aggregates of data, not necessarily looking at a single variable being changed and what difference does that make. It's actually looking at what's happening to our population here in different parts of the island, and are the stories that are being told true? And I think that true meaning, they're certainly true, but are they true in numbers that are meaningful that we can connect with the issues going on in the island? And if they are, that's an unbelievably important piece of knowledge for us to know. So again, you know, what's being said here is let's do the common sense things which are being called for, buffers and right to know, and then let's go further and collect the data that we have on Kauai, which is from multiple inputs and multiple potential causes for problems, and read that data.
Dr. Evans, I just want to ask one follow-up question. Are you able, or any of the doctors able, to spearhead that effort by contacting the Department of Health? What does it take to get that moved forward? Because I don't understand why this hasn't been done a decade ago. And can the doctors initiate that?
It would be best if it came from a government agency to initiate it. There's all kinds of privacy issues, so you have to be able to collect the data in a way that's completely private and meets all of the criteria for collecting data in that way. If the county council said we need to set up a committee to find this data and empowered it to be done properly, it could be done.
Okay.
And so one of the problems, Felicia, is that the onus of responsibility, and this is the EPA is forthright about this, is on the investigator to turn in that data. And as long as they're being cute with not turning in the data, then you run into privacy issues. And that's why it's difficult to get individuals or doctors or organizations to turn it in, because the adverse effects, it's mandated that the companies, the investigators who aren't being forthright, are the ones to report it to the governmental institutions. And it's a weird system, but that's the way it is.
There are ways to collect the data and keep it private, and certainly people at MIT know how to do that, so I might be able to talk to some people and we might be able to work something out.
That's great. Do you have a final thought, caller? I have some other callers very patient. You're a great call.
I just felt bad for that woman. And the final thought is that we sometimes rely on institutions and protector organizations, and in this movement, I just want to encourage the individuals that they are the movers. They will be the ones to bring this about. It won't be the institutions. It'll be the movement and that passion from the woman who called in who compels the institutions to mandate the studies, which we all know once they're done, the data will be there.
Right.
So I would just tell that woman and all the little the individuals who think they're not big enough to fight this fight, that this is the perfect situation on a small island with as many people passionate. Fight that fight, because that's how we'll get the government to mandate institutions to turn over that data.
Well, thank you for that insight. And I also thank all of our listeners who call and guests like the family that has come in to share. It's always difficult to be speaking of things like this on the air, and it really makes a powerful difference. So thank you, caller.
Thank you.
Aloha. Aloha, you're on the air.
Hello, is this me?
It's you. Thank you for being patient.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for taking my call. I have two or three things I want to talk about, but I'll try to make it as succinct as possible. I live down in Moloa, and all the water down here is well water, because the water was polluted many, many years ago by the pineapple growing up above. So my question is to anyone out there, Kapuna, anyone who used to work in that industry, if anyone knows specifically what pesticides were used, so that I can test my well water to see if 30, 40 years later it's still there. I know atrazine, DDT, and DBCP were all used, but I'm unaware of any other chemicals that were used back in that era. And the second part of that would be if any of your doctors or listeners out there know a lab that I could send a water sample to. Are you still there?
Yes, and Dave Giroux.
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm calling on Skype and I heard a funny noise.
Dave Giroux from Out of the Box, he is also Kauai Environmental, and he does, he's very smart in all of this, and I think he's kind of retired that business, but he is an excellent person to be speaking to, and he does environmental testing of all this sort for the government, for big developers, for small people, and the Department of Health also on Oahu, if you call, I think her name is Barbara Boxer. They've really looked at what's happened with the pesticides, and they will tell you a lot of what did work at Moloa. There's a whole published issue on that.
Thank you for that. I know that when you do submit water samples, you have to ask for a specific test.
Yes,
in that
you
area.
Do.
So you have to know exactly what you're looking for so you can order the correct test.
I tested my yard, yes.
And the second part of my comment and or question is I was born and raised in the San Joaquin Valley in a farming family, and I have a condition just diagnosed known as polycythemia vera. My body's making too many red blood cells, and they tell me it's a genetic mutation of a particular gene. And while I was listening to the program, it just occurred to me that my daughter has another very rare disease called fibrous dysplasia. And I don't know, need to go into the history of it, but while I was listening, it occurred to me that she was raised right in a rural orange-growing area in the San Joaquin Valley where they were just spraying tons of all kinds of chemicals, and including Roundup. So it's a very likely, they don't know what, you know, has caused that either. So I was wondering if either of the physicians have any insight or into either one of those conditions and their relationship to pesticides. And I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
I don't. It didn't come on any of the, neither of those two disease entities were mentioned in the research that I, that was done by the American Academy of Pediatrics that I'd become more knowledgeable on. What's your...
No, I mean, there are certainly issues with the blood. I would have to go back and research that, but I would like to do that to go see if there are connections, but I can't give you an answer, I'm sorry to say.
Okay, well, thanks. I'm actually still on the air. Just one final thought. If people are looking for data and data sets, the San Joaquin Valley in California would be one place where I would definitely look, because that place has been sprayed up and down with everything you can imagine for decades. And I know that there are cancer clusters all over the place, especially in the southern part around Delano and Bakersfield. So if there is anyone out there looking for data, you might choose to try to find it from that area.
That's Thanks a good
very
suggestion.
Much for taking my call.
Thank you. Aloha. Thank you for being patient. You're on the air. And this will be our last call.
Okay. Aloha, folks. How are you doing?
Good.
Good. What keeps bouncing around my head is that beautiful Indian woman. How do you pronounce her name, please?
Vandana Shiva.
Yes. Her speech was so incredible, so enlightening, so positive, so intelligent. And I think the last line that she said was, "And I won't be back until I've heard that you folks have driven the pesticide chemical people off the island." I think that was a sentence. And so I think it's going to take the people to do it. And I think that we have enough strong folks that have it in our to be able to do that. And another thing that bounces around in my head is the unborn children that we have here on this island that are not born yet. I feel for them so much, because they shouldn't be born with this's and that's and horrible things. They should be born with the most possibilities of beauty and intelligence and positivity that there is, not with all of those horrible negative effects. And we can make a difference to get these folks off the island. And that bill is a wonderful thing. But I'm afraid that those chemical companies are relying on the fact that it takes so much time to do all of these steps. I they sit in their little, you know, cubicles and laugh about it. Oh, yeah, they're going to have to collect facts. And, oh, yeah, they're going to have to do a report. And, oh, yeah, they're going to have to take an environmental impact study statement report. And all these things take so much time that those newborn or unborn babies, they're going to be born by that time. And they're going to have things happen to them. So I'm ready to fight. You know, I don't like to fight. I'm really not a fighter. So maybe it's another word. But whatever it is that I have to do to get those guys off the
we want them here. Okay.
We really don't, you know. And whatever it is that we can do, because I want that Indian woman to come back here. And she said she wouldn't until we have those folks off the island. So I'm ready to put my all in. Aloha.
Aloha. And then, actually, with Vandana Shiva, her right-hand woman is going to be here on July 31st, and we will be doing, I believe, we're working to see if we can do a live remote when she's here, and there's some folks from TED Talks, and a whole host of people are coming and doing an event on the 31st, so we will probably be playing that live. It'll be an interesting one. And, yeah, so that's what she said. I had a couple of thoughts that escaped me now. But so I want to go around the room and be able to give everybody a quality final thought for what you're wanting to share with the listeners. And then we'll be hearing Jazz with John after that.
Well, for me, it was an interesting time period listening to the callers and to the comments being made here. The thoughts that crossed my mind as I listened to all of this, one thought as a ex-administrator and so on is...
Of the hospital.
Of the hospital. For a small rural community, we actually have a very good medical care system. I've been to many rural communities and many places that are big urban centers, and I've always been extremely impressed from the day I arrived here in 1979 and even more so now what we have available to us. Not that we don't have our issues and not that medical care doesn't have its major issues, but I do think we have a surprisingly good system for a small rural area, number one. Number two is we're talking about data collection, and I think it's very important to repeat the fact that the American Academy of Pediatrics, in its policy statement and its technical report, is saying the data is there, the data is scary. Not only is the data there, but our knowledge base, both from the physicians and from the regulators, isn't great enough. And for those that are spraying the pesticides, they may certainly be following all of the standards that are currently set, and they may not be, but they may be. And the problem is that we don't yet know what standards are good enough. So they're telling us very clearly, be careful of what you spray in your house, be careful of what you spray in your yard, and that agricultural workers, may both male and females, may be at particular risk for bringing those chemicals home to their unborn and born children, and that we need to pay attention to that. And they're saying there are things we can do this moment before we do more studies, and those are buffers and right to know, better labeling, better education of our physicians, more regulatory action by the regulatory agencies, and in particular, as was brought up here many times, we don't yet know ways to identify these poisons well enough, and it should be mandated. And that was, I think, their word, actually, that the government mandate that better biomarkers are created so we can know when we're dealing with poisoning. And then, so I think 2491 is very important because it allows us to do those things that need to be done now, create the buffers, do the right to know. Then in addition, my guess is that on the island of Kauai, unfortunately, we may have a mind full of information about actually the effect of these from multiple causes coming out into what happens to people. And we need to look at our data. And I do think that whatever agency would be in charge of making sure such studies were done in the proper fashion so that full privacy is maintained and so on needs to be done. The data is actually there. It just needs to be mined correctly. And I don't even think it would be that difficult to get a lot of the data. So I call for all of these things. Let's do what's intelligent. Let's do what's being called for by bodies as scientific as the American Academy of Pediatrics. Let's collect the data. And I would ask one last thing is that we, this is going to be an impossible request, but we're a small island in the middle of the sea and we need each other. And somehow it would be wonderful if we can do this in a way that's not adversarial. I'm sure it's pie in the sky that that's not necessarily what's going to happen. But we're in this together, and we're in this on this little teeny dot in the middle of the ocean, and I would love it if we find ways to kind of draw together to say, okay, all of us, we agree we need buffers. West side, east side, blue shirts, red shirt, of course we need buffers around our schools. Of course we need the right to know. So we can move from there onto other subjects. And of course we need to know what the data, how could anybody disagree with the fact we need to know what the data shows? So that's where I'm coming from. I wish us all the best.
And thank you. And hopefully I feel like maybe they can just change their agricultural practices. We don't even have to drive them away. They just need to be have a healthier design. It's out of date. It's out of fashion. No more poisons. Let's grow healthy food. Nate, do you just want to say aloha? We're going to got to kind of move through quickly to be saying aloha, and then we're going to go to the county council report and then jazz with John.
Yeah, all I can say is mahalo for having me here, and to all the listeners, mahalo for listening. Choose life, not money. That's all I can say to the people who work for those companies.
Very important.
Thank you for having me on the show. Thank you to the doctors out there that take such good care of our kids. I also want to say one more thing, and it's to the council. If you think that there's a chance, even if it's like a 0.005% chance that this stuff is harming our kids, for me, for my child, pass the bill. Pass the bill. It's just a tiny, tiny little percent, a tiny chance that this could be affecting our children should be more than enough to pass this bill.
I was really struck when Wendy talked about all of the different things that are conditions in her family that directly...
Randy.
About the conditions in her family that were directly related to the things that I've identified with these toxic herbicides. And I think that we really need... People need to wake up, and I think that individuals can make a huge difference. If people will just vote with their pocketbook, buy organic food, they will feel better, and they will promote the organic industry. I think there's a really strong and thriving. I was delighted to hear the person on the, who called in and talked about this organic program teaching the children. This island, I mean, my vision for the future is that this island is 100% organic and that we are providing food for ourselves and possibly even exporting organic food to people elsewhere who are going to want the organic food once people realize how toxic this stuff is. The methods that they are using in the in this chemical farming are going to fail. They're obviously going to fail. They're on a out-of-control movement right now towards more and more chemicals, more and more problems with these weeds, and more issues with our health. This has to stop. And it's just a matter of at what point do people finally wake up and realize. And I think the answer is going to come from the general public. Individuals will make individual decisions to only eat organic food, and that will pressure the farmers, because farmers one by one will say, hey, I'm going to grow organic because I can get a good price, people want it, and then eventually I'm hoping we can turn this around.
Yeah, it's the fashion of food. Well, that completes us for today. I'll leave with the thought, come to the next Regeneration Seed Exchange September 22nd, a party of aloha, love, and sharing of plants.